It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. U.S.-backed Iraqi forces fighting the Islamic State in western Mosul have as a key objective to capture a bridge over the Tigris River linking the city's eastern and western sectors. A capture would make it easier to reinforce the assault force with troops and supplies from the east, which was secured in January. James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, tells VOA the latest objective, the offensive, is making great progress.
This is going better than expected, but it often happens in a major battle that at some point, particularly if you're besieged and you're under constant air attack, the other side begins to crack. And the other thing is they start thinking seriously about, can they withdraw and fight another day?
The offensive in western Mosul, home to an estimated 750,000 civilians, was launched a week ago. Meantime, thousands are fleeing their homes, and the UN Refugee Agency has said it's focusing its efforts on building new camps to house the displaced. Mosul's capture would end the Islamic State control of a major urban area in Iraqi, a city where is declared a caliphate in 2014. UN peacekeeping mission MINUSCA has carried out airstrikes in the Central African Republic against what he called heavily armed fighters advancing on the city of Bambari. About 40 fighters from the Popular Front for the Renaissance of Central African Republic were said to be armed with assault rifles and rocket-propelled grenades and were preparing an attack. The FPRC has been battling with rival militia. This is VOA News. Former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has published a lengthy open letter to President Donald Trump in which he applauded the American leader for, in his words, truthfully describing the U.S. political system and electoral structure as corrupt. Shamran Akbarzadeh is an Iranian analyst at Australia's Deakin University.
It's actually not a surprise because Ahmadinejad has written to other U.S. presidents in the past. I think he's written to Obama and also to George W. Bush. So he enjoys writing letters. It's somewhat comical that he thinks he can provide advice to President Trump now, but it's not out of character for him.
Referring to him as His Excellency, Excellency Mr. Donald John Trump, Ahmadinejad, who left office in 2013, urged the U.S. to end its meddling in the affairs of other nations, which he said leads to war, division, killing, and displacement. And he described the dominance of the U.S. in the United Nations, which he said obstructs its right performance. Ahmadinejad also called for respect to all immigrants in the U.S., including a million Iranian Americans. Syrian forces appear to have made advances on the Islamic State positions as Syrian political talks in Geneva appear to be going nowhere to ending the 6-year conflict. Reports indicate government forces advanced into areas held by IS militants in the northwest following the fall of the IS-held al-Bab to the Turkish-backed rebels. Another report indicates that they are pushing toward the eastern IS-held ancient city of Palmyra. And in Geneva, the main opposition group, the High Negotiations Committee, is accusing Damascus of stalling and insisting on face-to-face talks. Ingo Matasanam Swifi is with the Day After Syria campaign.
We believe that they are not serious here to engage into serious political discussion, rather than gaining more time and continuing their military strategy on the ground, to translate it later into a political negotiations.
And the head of the Cairo opposition group said while there is diversity within the opposition, it is not fragmented. The fourth round of talks began Thursday. At the 89th Academy Awards ceremony in Los Angeles, Casey Affleck won Best Actor for his role in the film Manchester by the Sea. Best Actress Award went to Emma Stone for La La Land. Best Film, Moonlight. The Syrian war documentary The White Helmets won the Short Documentary Academy Award. Get more news at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today is Monday, February 27th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye confirms an initiative is in the making for a dialogue between him and President Yoweri Museveni.
Indeed, there have been initiatives to have dialogue that centers on that and broader political questions relating to electoral management and other issues affecting the country now.
First, Dr. Kizza Besigye of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change. The IOM fears further escalation of anti-immigrant violence in South Africa. Washington-based South Sudan students weigh in on the conflict in their country, and Sudan says it needs international help to cope with the influx of thousands of South Sudan refugees.
They come in a very bad situation. They are ill, they are starved, they have nothing, and so forth. They need very rapid help. And I think Sudan, with all its resources, cannot fill this gap. So we need help.
Ahmed Bilal is Sudan's information minister, and the annual Mount Cameroon race has taken place with heavy security. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley sports and our Black History Month facts and trivia questions are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan opposition leader Dr. Kizza Besigye has confirmed that there have been initiatives by what he calls concerned groups of citizens for a dialogue to take place between him, his Forum for Democratic Change party, and longtime leader President Yoweri Museveni. Besigye says such talks, if they become a reality, will center on what he calls the inconclusive 2016 presidential election and other issues affecting the country. The idea of talks between President Museveni and Dr. Besigye was first reported last week by the Ugandan Monitor newspaper, citing sources close to both sides. Dr. Besigye tells me that such a dialogue, if it becomes a reality, can only make progress if it is managed in a transparent and structured way by a credible foreign mediator accepted by both sides. He also says both sides must be legally binding to implement the outcomes.
I'd like to first of all point out that since the last election in February last year, there have been fundamental political challenges in our country, one of which is that the election itself was not conclusive. Indeed, there have been initiatives to have dialogue that centers on that and broader political questions relating to electoral management and other issues affecting the country now. So those initiatives, we have made it clear, can only be make progress if they are managed transparently in a structured way, where we get a credible mediator accepted by both sides, and where the agenda for the dialogue is clear, and where we have an understanding of a legally binding framework that will ensure implementation of the outcomes. So some conversation has been going on around those issues through various initiatives, but nothing conclusive has as yet emerged.
So, Dr. Besigye, these conversations, are they originating from you, the opposition leader, or from President Museveni, or are they mutual?
No, actually, they have been originating from concerned groups of citizens mainly, who took initiative to see whether there can be something that is broached by way of a dialogue.
This dialogue, if it becomes reality, is it between you, the opposition leader, and President Museveni, or is it between the NRM and the opposition in Uganda?
As I have pointed out, the question of the election itself is a concern that affects me as a former candidate in the last election and the FDC that I represented in that election, our political party. We are the aggrieved party here. And so in resolving that, that is an issue that concerns us specifically. But regarding the broader questions of electoral and constitutional reforms, these are clearly national issues that all parties will have to engage with.
Dr. Besigye, given your experiences with the government and President Museveni, do you have any confidence?
Well, clearly, President Museveni is somebody who has, I think, excelled in a show of dishonesty. I don't think that he inspires any confidence in political players anywhere in the region. But that does not mean that we close ourselves to the possible process of dialogue, because I think it has to be understood that these are matters that affect the country and cannot be limited to the credibility of just one person. And that is why, indeed, we have been keen to have a credible facilitator, someone who can ensure that all parties behave according to the process that has been established.
Dr. Kizza Besigye is the former presidential candidate of Uganda's main opposition party, Forum for Democratic Change. He was speaking with me from Amsterdam in the Netherlands. The government of Sudan says it needs international help to meet the humanitarian needs of the tens of thousands of South Sudanese refugees who have been pouring into the country. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on yesterday, Sunday, that 32,000 South Sudanese entered Sudan since the start of this year alone. The agency said it was initially expecting up to 60,000 for the entire 2017. Sudan Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says his government initially accepted the South Sudanese because they were once citizens of Sudan. But he said when they started to arrive by the tens of thousands, his country, with all its resources, could no longer cope. Bilal said the needs are great because some of the refugees come in very bad conditions. Bilal said the international community should also focus on ending the South Sudan conflict, which he said is the main cause of the displacement.
First of all, we started to treat them as citizens, not as refugees, because some of them, they know Sudan very well because we were one country and they go to the place they want. But after a big rush started and many of them come, they come beyond our capability. That's why we consider them as refugees, so that we can get help from the international community for that. The people who are coming through different avenues to Sudan are many. 32,000, this is those we could count. But maybe double this number. They come from different places, and they come because they know Sudan very well. And they come in a very bad situation. They are ill, they are starved, they have nothing, and so forth. They need a very rapid help. And I think Sudan, with all its resources, cannot fill this gap. So we need help, but we, our duty, and this humanitarian movement, we are going to open the borders and to receive them, to give them shelter, to give them treatment, to give them food, and this so forth.
The UN Refugee Agency, Mr. Minister, is appealing for $166 million to meet the needs of the South Sudanese refugees. Are you getting help from the UN Refugee Agency?
So far, very, very, very little is being given. We need more, actually. You know, we can actually even go inside the country to help those, the children and the ill persons, to move them from inside the south to Sudan or to the border in a safe place. Now, as the General Secretary of the UN said, there are four countries suffering from starvation. One of them is southern Sudan. The others may be for the natural causes, drought and these things. But in the south, the main cause is war. So I think the real help should not be only giving food to these people, but a pressure and an interference from the international community to stop the war. This is mad war is the main cause, and if it continues, many people are going to die from starvation or from the war. So I think Sudan can play a crucial role in this, and we are ready to play that. I think a national dialogue can happen in Khartoum. Although IGAD is now holding this file, and we are actually moving with them together, but I think the real solution is in Sudan. We know these people, all of them, very well. They are trusting us, and al-Bashir can play a big role in such situation to bring peace to the south.
Ahmed Bilal, Sudan's information minister, he was speaking with me from Khartoum. Today is Monday, February 27th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The ongoing violence in South Sudan has at many times dominated international headlines since the conflict there erupted in late 2013. Diplomats, politicians, and activists have all worked to change the course of violence in the young country, but the situation has only gotten worse. Some college students here in the Washington, D.C. area say changing matters in South Sudan is possible only if policymakers pursue a different approach. Viewer's Ayem Bio has the details.
Sandra Tombe describes herself as an ambitious and hardworking South Sudanese American. She's 25 years old and is earning a doctoral degree at George Mason University in conflict resolution, which she hopes to use to help people in her native country. Although hopeful, Tombe says she is not naive and is aware that achieving long-term change in South Sudan could take some time.
That's the thing. I think we sometimes think of change as something that is radical, something that transforms society in a way that's unimaginable. But change happens on a very small level. And so if we each take the responsibility individually to contribute to society and to contribute to resolving the conflict in South Sudan, then we can actually achieve something. And we're not going to see that change over, you know, night, but it's something that on a daily basis we have to be working on it.
23-year-old American University student Lu Jingjiang agrees, but says that policymakers and diplomats have so far taken the wrong approach to helping the people in South Sudan. He told VOA the international community should focus more on building the country's infrastructure to create an atmosphere where democratic ideals and civic engagement can flourish.
I'm a realist. So again, I think human rights and the political campaign, they're important. But I think what's more important is how many schools you have, how many hospitals you have, right? How many South Sudanese can be benefited from that so that they can make money, they can have family, they can let their children go to school. So in the end, you look at the big picture.
But for other students like Dao Dol Dol, a rising South Sudanese American junior at the School of International Studies at American University, the conflict is much more personal. And he says for countless young people like him, who once called Kenya's large Kakuma refugee camp home, all he has ever known is war.
Most of the youth, most South Sudanese youth, were born in the refugee camp, were born during the war, were displaced during the war. So all we have known our whole life, I'm 21 years old, and all I have known is war. Now, how do we change that? We have to change the cycle of warrior-like mentality that we have in South Sudan, and we're torn our own house apart. So we have to change something. Something has to change. There are absolutely no words to describe it, because we were so full of joy, we were so full of hope.
Tombe agrees.
The fact that some people are impacted, that means all of us are impacted, and that we have a role each to play in that as students and as people who are hoping to kind of step into leadership roles. And so it's something that we need to take on now and build into it into the future, and not something that we assume, you know, after we finish school, for example, or after we get a real job, but it's something that we're incrementally building upon.
The United Nations and the government of South Sudan declared famine in parts of the country last week, and aid workers complained that delivering life-saving aid to displaced communities has proven difficult under deadly security conditions, as well as a lack of roads for easy accessibility. The South Sudanese government has made plans to initiate a national dialogue, which they say is designed to end hostilities and bring divided communities to the table. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, says it is concerned about the latest anti-immigrant violence in South Africa and warns of a further escalation of the root causes if the root causes of the xenophobic riots are not tackled. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration condemns the spate of anti-immigrant violence organized by individual citizens and community associations in Rosettenville, south of Johannesburg, and in the South African capital of Pretoria. It is calling for calm and for an end to the attacks, looting, and burning of property owned by foreign nationals earlier this week. South African protesters accused the African migrants of taking their jobs and being responsible for a rise in crime. IOM spokesman Itai Viriri says those who have grievances against the migrants should not take the law into their own hands. They should air their complaints with the local authorities.
because there's no real tangible evidence that there's an increase in crime because of migrants. On the contrary, research shows that immigrants who go to South Africa mostly do not harm the long-term employment prospects and wages of native-born workers. In fact, quite a lot of them create small businesses. And in fact, most of those who are being targeted now are small business owners.
Viriri tells VOA that IOM fears the violence could get worse because migrants say they plan to mobilize themselves for their own protection.
Right now, what is happening is that we have a situation whereby some of the migrants are, unlike last time, saying that they're going to protect themselves. And by that virtue, it sort of escalates the whole situation. Before, we didn't have maybe a situation whereby the migrants said they were going to stand up for themselves or not wait for police protection. Obviously, that's very worrisome because it escalates the whole situation.
Indeed, a standoff between anti-immigrant protesters and migrants during a march organized by the Mamelodi Concerned Residents in Pretoria Friday turned violent. Police had to use tear gas, rubber bullets, and water cannon to try to disperse the groups. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good morning to you, James. We begin with the 2017 CAF Under 20 African Cup of Nations, which got underway in Zambia on Sunday. It was the host, the Young Chipolopolo, who got their campaign off on a winning note after beating the Junior Sele National of Guinea by 1-0. Patson Daka scored the only goal of the game to earn Zambia the win. Coach of the Young Chipolopolo, Besting Quicksilver Chimbeshi, says they will do their best to go far in the tournament. Egypt and Mali played to a goalless draw in the other opening Group A match at the Heroes National Stadium in Lusaka on Sunday afternoon. The result leaves Egypt and Mali tied in second place in Group A behind Zambia on 3 points, while Guinea prop up the standings with 0 points. The next set of under-20 AFCON fixtures take place on Monday as Group B gets underway with Senegal taking on Sudan, while Cameroon will go up against South Africa. The South Africa under-20 national football team coach Thabo Senong is confident there's enough quality players in his squad to excel at the CAF Under-20 African Cup of Nations tournament in Zambia. Away from the Under-20 AFCON tournament, FIFA President Gianni Infantino wound up his visit to Uganda by promising that the World Soccer Governing Body is keen to lend more support to the development of local football on the continent. However, the FIFA president, who spent the last week in Africa meeting with the 54 Football Federation president, was careful not to be drawn to the politics of football on the continent at the time his visit comes just weeks before the Confederation of African Football elections. And now to news surrounding some African players playing their trade outside the continent. French-born Gazalec Ajaccio defender Cedric Houtoundji has confirmed his decision to commit his international future to Benin. Writing on his Facebook page, the France under-21 centre-back said he decided to play for Benin, his father's country of origin, because it will be of great pride to wear the national team colours of Benin Republic. And pre-Emerick Aubameyang ended his goal drought after 471 minutes of action to score twice on Saturday as Borussia Dortmund tightened their hold on third place with a 3-0 victory at Freiburg. Andrea Yu, on the other hand, came in as substitute to score a goal away to Watford in a Hartford 1-1 draw on Saturday in one of the English Premier League games. And to some not-too-good news, DR Congo's Yannick Bolasie may not play for Everton again until the end of the 2017 season, with manager Ronald Koeman confirming that the winger will undergo a second operation on his knee. The 27-year-old, who joined from Crystal Palace in August for an initial fee of £25 million, played every game for Everton until injuring his anterior cruciate ligament against Manchester United on December the 4th, 2016. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. And Daybreak Africa time now is 25 minutes past the hour. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 27th. On this day in 1988, Debbie Thomas became the first African-American figure skater to win a medal of bronze at the Winter Olympics in Calgary, Canada. Thomas also won the World Figure Skating Championship in 1986. Debbie Thomas went on to become a medical doctor. Also on this day in 1853, the first black YMCA was organized in Washington, D.C. by Anthony Bowen. Back then, African-Americans were excluded from the existing YMCAs. On this day in 1902, African-American and world-renowned opera singer Miriam Anderson was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She went on to be the first African-American to perform at the White House. Also on this day in 1869, the U.S. Congress adopted the 15th Constitutional Amendment. It made it illegal for the United States or any local or state government to deny or abridge the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And today in Black History, we want to tell you about Condoleezza Rice. Born on November 14, 1954 in Birmingham, Alabama, Rice grew up surrounded by racism in the segregated South, but she went on to become the first woman and African-American to serve as provost of Stanford University. In 2001, Rice was appointed National Security Advisor by President George W. Bush, becoming the first black woman and second woman to hold the post. In 2005, Rice became the first black woman to serve as U.S. Secretary of State. On this day in African history, in 1999, voters in Nigeria elected Olusegun Obasanjo president to end 15 years of military rule. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 27th. Congratulations to Samson Kolan of the Cocoa Research Institute in New Tafoakim, Eastern Region of Ghana, and Hiram K. Meno, care of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in Monrovia, Liberia. You are the winners of our February 24 question, which African-American played a key role in the construction of Washington, D.C.? The answer, Benjamin Beinecke. Now, here is our question for today, February 27th. Which 19th century inventor is known as the Black Thomas Edison? Once again, which 19th century inventor is known as the Black Thomas Edison? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. Stand up for your right. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Ugandan opposition leader Kizza Besigye has confirmed there have been initiatives of what he calls concerned groups of citizens for a dialogue to take place between him, his Forum for Democratic Change Party, and longtime leader President Yoweri Museveni. Besigye says such talks, if they become a reality, will center on what he calls the inconclusive 2016 presidential election and other issues affecting the country. That's it for this Monday, February 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting your week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone a very productive week.
Tuesday on Health Chat. February is Heart Health Month in the United States. Host Lenore Moudou will end the month with a look at children and heart disease. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.